The citizens of both the United States and Iraq tell pollsters in overwhelming numbers that they want U.S. troops to withdraw. The progress report last week on Bush's surge of U.S. troops may have been mixed, but it was in no way successful. Though individual Republican lawmakers are pulling away from Bush, the Democrats have failed so far to deliver on their mandate to end the war. Meanwhile, the costs of the war at home, in Iraq, and around the world continue to mount. This did not have to happen. The U.S. did not have to invade Iraq. Iraq did not have to dominate our attention and squander our resources and our national purpose. At this moment, I will welcome once again Iraq veteran Paul Rykoff, whose book Chasing Ghosts is the first criticism of the Iraq War and President Bush that was written by a soldier who actually fought in Iraq. Rykoff served on the front lines in Baghdad as the insurgency emerged in 2003, and he offers a troop's eye view. Chasing Ghosts is how he and his soldiers described fighting a lethal and nearly invisible enemy. Rykoff also writes of his return in 2004 to the United States, preoccupied with reality TV and celebrity scandals. IAVA, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, is the nation's first and largest organization for veterans of wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, representing more than 60,000 members in all 50 states. Paul Rykoff is one of its founders and its executive director. He's also a frequent contributor to the nation's press. He blogs at the Huffington Post, and he's just published his first book, the one I mentioned above, Chasing Ghosts, Failures and Facades in Iraq, A Soldier's Perspective. Welcome again, Paul Rykoff.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Okay, for those who aren't familiar with your story, Paul, could you briefly relate how an Amherst grad ends up in Baghdad, and then how he ends up one of the leaders of the largest veterans organization of this century's wars?
Sure. It wasn't something I had planned on, I have to tell you that, at least the activism part. I joined the military after I graduated from Amherst in 1998. Out of a sense of patriotism, I wanted to give something back to the country that I really believe has given me so much. My grandfather had served during World War II for 3 years in the South Pacific, and my father had been drafted during Vietnam, and there was a history of military service in my family. So I definitely wanted to give something back, and I also had a sense of, I guess, a taste for adventure. I wanted to jump out of airplanes and play with guns and do some of those other things, I think, that attract a lot of people to the military. And pretty soon found myself in Iraq and had misgivings about the war before it even started. I was very concerned about the rationale for war, our preparedness, the country's willingness and ability to mobilize behind what I saw was a questionable war effort. And when I got into Iraq, I saw the poor planning and limited vision of this administration and all the faults of the war that have now become commonplace firsthand, really up close and personal. And when I came home, I was ticked off, and I wanted to do something to try to push our country back on track, to galvanize other veterans and to challenge this president and a lot of the assumptions that he had made about the war. And I guess that's where a lot of activism comes from, is that sense of urgency and social justice and wanting to change the way the world is.
When you signed up, there are some people who sign up when we're at peace and then find themselves at war. When you signed up, was it pretty clear that there might very well be a war in your future?
No, not at all. I mean, when I came out of basic training, we were talking about Yugoslavia and Milosevic, and that was really the only type of conflict that was on our radar, and we assumed that that would be a low-intensity, some sort of peacekeeping mission. That was as intense as it got back in 1998, and I had gone back into the reserves in 1999 and was working as an investment banker on Wall Street and serving in the National Guard on weekends. And back then, a lot of my bosses assumed that National Guard duty was just drinking beer and sitting in an armory, where we were actually training in the woods and qualifying on weapons, ready for something that might happen. But we never would have envisioned 9/11 happening. That wasn't at all on our radar. I found myself down there participating in the rescue effort with the New York Army National Guard, and then was later deployed to Iraq. But I think most of us at that time never would have anticipated a protracted war of this kind at all.
Right. In other words, so even when you may have been a bit gung-ho for combat, you had bought a bit the idea that this would be a swift and awesome victory?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the opening line of my book is George Bush had better be effing right. And I think that I was very concerned about the fact that the president was basing his entire rationale on a convoluted argument. It was a shifting target, as I saw it, and I felt if you were going to mobilize a country behind war, our intentions had to be clear. You had to have overwhelming support from the people, and you had to have a clear vision about what you were trying to accomplish and what the end state looked like. And in so many ways, it just really reeked to me of Vietnam. And ultimately, I saw this as the mother of all poker games. Bush had finally decided weapons of mass destruction was the rationale he can mobilize the American people behind, and he had better been right, in my opinion, because if he wasn't, there'd be a catastrophic cost for all sides involved, and I think, unfortunately, that's the way it turned out, and that's where we are now.
I got an email today from IAVA, signed by you, Paul. It told the story of Specialist Jonathan Town. Let me just read what they wrote, and then I'll let you expand on this. Quote, it's a situation so terrible it's almost impossible to believe. A young soldier is injured in Iraq when a rocket hits a wall 2 feet above his head. He suffers hearing loss, headaches, memory problems. Then he's discharged without medical benefits or disability pay and told he must return part of his enlistment bonus, meaning he actually owes the Army $3,000. Like 22,000 other servicemen and women since 2001, John Town was separated from the military for what was deemed a pre-existing personality disorder. That means the Army has decided that Specialist Town's medical problems existed before his military service. Consequently, they avoid having to pay for his medical care. What's going on here, Paul?
Well, we chose to spotlight John Town's story because it's part of a larger problem. As many as 22,000 members of our military have been discharged under what the military calls a personality disorder. So somebody like John Town, who served his country honorably, received a Purple Heart, and come home, you know, expecting, and I think rightfully so, resources and benefits to deal with those injuries, has found himself being pushed out of the military because of this loophole. Thousands of other soldiers have gone through this, and ABC did a fantastic piece on this last week that ran on Nightline and World News by Bob Woodruff, and Bob Woodruff was the anchor that was wounded terribly in Iraq after a roadside bomb hit him, and he's really been on a mission to expose these stories, and we were happy to work with him to try to reveal the truth in a situation affecting this young soldier and thousands of others. So we're working on Capitol Hill to push for change. We're demanding an investigation from the Department of Defense, and we're going to continue to push these stories in the media that are really out of most people's day-to-day life. You know, right now the news media is plastered with Chris Benoit, the wrestler, and the steroid issue.
But right.
We've got to try to refocus people on the tremendous causes and consequences of this war that are going to affect us for decades.
Okay, I want you to... my question is, what should people know about how vets are doing and what can they do about it? But I'm also going to add that Jim Nicholson resigned his post today as Secretary of the Department of Veterans Affairs. Where does that fit into this picture?
Well, that's welcome news for us. We've been a vocal critic of Nicholson really since the war began. I've repeatedly called him the FEMA director Mike Brown that America doesn't know about. Secretary Nicholson has been woefully out of touch with what's happening inside the VA. There's been a backlog of hundreds of thousands of claims. There was a $3 billion shortfall in the budget. He was overseeing an administration that lost the Social Security numbers and personal data of over 26 million veterans of all generations. And he's consistently downplayed the demands on the VA. He keeps telling everybody everything's fine.
Where else would you hear that?
Yeah. Exactly. So this is welcome news that this guy is out. His prior jobs include being the ambassador to the Vatican, and before that, heading the Republican National Committee. So he had no previous experience that really prepared him for this job, and too often he found himself defending the administration instead of defending our veterans.
Okay, so back to that other question that I asked. What should people know about how vets are doing, and what can they do? Specifically, maybe, might they be dropping some sort of note to their representatives about who they think might be capable of replacing Nicholson?
Well, that's a big reason why we created the organization. And if people are looking for something to do, they can go to our website, IAVA.org. And we've tried to make it easy. If you don't know a lot about veterans' issues, you don't know somebody who's personally served, you should know that you can still support veterans coming home. It doesn't matter if you're for this war or against it. We all, as Americans, have a moral obligation to take care of those people who've served. So we have petitions that you can sign. There's legislative agenda items that we have on our website that you can support. Or you can just host a house party locally for a documentary, or there'll be informational panels. There's video and print information that you can download off the website. We've tried to make it very easy for everyone. If you have 5 minutes or 5 hours, there's something on our website that you can do to help these folks coming home.
Okay. Were you surprised yourself that taking care of the vets wasn't considered part of the cost of going to war? And as I was thinking about this, I thought, why can't the military make that a deal breaker? We don't get on the ships, we don't get on the planes unless, you know, I'm being a little facetious, but you'd think they would have the kind of power where when the decisions are being made, they could say, you know, in addition to the $12 billion we're spending in Iraq, we got to have the money on hand to pay for taking care of the people when they come home.
That would be the right way to do it, and I think veterans around the country have been shocked to see that that type of planning hasn't been done. I think America is aware, finally, of the lack of planning and the incompetence that's riddled the operations inside Iraq and even inside Afghanistan. But this is the other side of the war, where the Bush administration failed to plan and failed to allocate resources, that's just now starting to reveal itself. The fiasco at Walter Reed, in my opinion, is really just the tip of the iceberg. The number of claims waiting over 6 months inside the VA has doubled recently to 83,000. The average wait time for a veteran on a claim is 177 days. Tens of thousands of veterans are waiting for the first primary care appointment. That number is over 30,000 now. So there's a huge influx of veterans coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan, 1.6 million of them, who are going to be really pushing the very fabric of our society. And the first stop for most of them is going to be the VA. And the VA is woefully and dangerously underprepared to receive them.
Right. The conspiracy, again, somewhat facetious, but the conspiracy nut in me says, well, if you're going to demonstrate that single-payer government health care doesn't work, this is how you do it.
Right. Well, I mean, that's an interesting point, because what I've found, and I'm still a novice learning how to work my way around Washington, but what we found is that funding for the VA has become wrapped up in this argument over socialized health care, nationalized health care. The VA is the largest health care system in America, and it does have its faults, but at the same time, it does provide incredibly low prescription costs, for example.
Mm-hmm.
It does have a model that's worthy of examining and potentially replicating, and veterans get pulled in to this larger partisan debate about health care.
Yeah, in other words, it would actually, if we had a government that wanted to care for everyone in the country, they could start by making the VA a model program and showing that this can be done.
Exactly.
Let me just say one thing that occurs to me also as I'm preparing for this is, and I don't, this is somewhat rhetorical, and then I want to move to, let's talk about Iraq itself. Why did, and this is that rhetorical question, why did Americans let this administration abuse our troops so consistently with extended and repeated tours of duty for a war that was always a questionable call? So we're hurting our troops, we're hurting their families, we're hurting their communities. Why can't we get the country to care more about some of our best young people than about the Cheney Bush group's need to prove it's right when it has been wrong at every turn? Something that gets to people's hearts?
Yeah, no matter how you cut it, for me, it always goes back to one simple thing. Most Americans are not affected by this war. Less than 1% of the American population has served in Iraq and Afghanistan. In World War II, it was as high as 12% sometimes. So most Americans nowadays don't have someone in their family that's been personally affected. In World War II and previous generations, someone at your job, someone at your school, someone in your home was directly, personally impacted by the war that was going on. And this war, in many ways, is invisible. So, you know, our military and our families, military families are at war, but most Americans are watching American Idol and shopping.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that really does drive policy, both having to do with extensions and the rate of deployment, but also how we treat our veterans coming home.
Right.
Veterans and military personnel have become kind of this other that for the most part aren't really interacting with the general public on a day-to-day basis. And that personal connection, that visceral family connection, I think is what most effectively drives policy going forward. If we had a draft tomorrow,
yep,
this would all change.
Absolutely. Now, according to VoteVets.org, another email I got recently, and tell me, this also seems to be something quite different from previous wars. A May New York Times poll of troops and their families found 2/3 thought the president's strategy was not working, and a Zogby poll last year showed 72% of troops on the ground thought the U.S. should redeploy within a year. Do these numbers surprise you, and do you think that the public or even the media have any sense of this?
It doesn't surprise me, and I think the media and the public are gaining a better understanding of our military. Although those numbers are small, I think over the course of this war, they've gotten to know the men and women fighting in it a little bit better. And they should know that, you know, we're not a monolithic, robotic group. We reflect the American society and the American fabric, and just as the president and the war have lost popularity within the general public, they've lost support within the military, even more so to some extent. We've seen the mismanagement and the neglect and the poor planning, especially, that impacted us personally. So many people within the military have their criticisms, and often very passionate ones, but they have to be a lot more careful in how they voice them. These few public opinion polls do give us a good bit of insight, but I think over time we'll start to get a better idea as these folks recycle, because that's another element that is new. In past generations, people got out. Mm-hmm. Everybody always says to me, where are all the Iraq and Afghanistan vets? Why aren't they protesting? Why aren't they involved? Well, because most of them are back in Iraq and Afghanistan for a second and third tour. And that unprecedented recycling of our troops is really unprecedented and dramatically impacts their ability to come back into our communities, come back into our radio shows, and start to educate America about what's happening.
Sure. Let's turn to the big picture. How can 300 million Americans allow this war in Iraq to continue in their name, sacrificing their children and their health care and their education dollars and their constitution for a war of lies, incompetence, chaos, corruption, and death that breeds only hatred and more death? How, as you have been gone there, fought there, come back, been working with vets all along, how is it that we can't stop this?
Well, I think it goes back to that connection. I think that a lot of people find it unsavory. A lot of people find it to be a bit disconcerting, but I think most Americans don't do anything about it. I mean, most Americans don't even vote. So I think that there's a tremendous amount of discontent, but there's also a disconnect from the political system and from activism. And I think that the Internet has changed that to some extent and made it easier. But this is not the nation that it was back in 1969. And I think that the draft, again, does have an impact on that and changes the landscape. But most folks just aren't personally getting themselves invested in the direction of our foreign policy. And I think that is changing. The numbers are growing. But it's a surprisingly small amount. And I think there's another factor here, too. I think most Americans are realistic about the fact that there's probably no good outcome in Iraq.
Right.
I think they recognize that if we stay, it's going to be bad. If we leave, it's going to be bad. And there isn't an easy solution. People want to get out, but they don't know how. And they don't know how soon. They don't know in what fashion. They don't know how to deal with Iran or Israel or the other factors in the region. And it's a very complicated scenario. And I would argue one of the biggest complex issues of our time. And I think there's no easy answer here. And I think that often discourages people from getting involved. And I would argue we need them exactly because of that. Because it's so complex, we need everybody's voice. We need everybody's mind involved so we can, as a country, not as Republicans or Democrats, tackle this most important issue of our time.
You know, as I look at it, it's, you know, one thing would be what is going to bring us to our senses. But it seems that if you look at poll numbers, you know, whether it's from the 06 election or since, it looks like people get it. But I think maybe what you just said is right, is that, so I get it, I hate it, I wish it were over, but then when I look at the options, I get a little frozen. I mean, what we need is, of course, to force our government and elected leaders to take decisive action that ends the occupation, that changes the situation on the ground. And it strikes me that all planning and all action should take that end as a given, but I think you're right that it's this... If what would be, there is no good outcome, it seems, and so people have trouble mobilizing to that real stage of demanding one outcome over another.
Sure, and I think there's really a void of leadership. I think what we've seen within the Democratic Party is a lot of pandering and poll watching, and the Republican Party has been, for the most part, in lockstep with the president, with the exception of brave people like Chuck Hagel. I think that there's a real void of leadership in Washington, and politics in general is really disappointing the American public. We don't have faith in politicians from either side to get the people's work done, not only on Iraq, but on issues like immigration and others.
Yeah.
So I think that generally there's a huge frustration and there's been a lack of leaders to emerge, and maybe the presidential campaign in 08 will start to make that a different scenario, where we've got somebody like Obama or Hillary that emerge and have a more clear plan for Iraq. But I think until now, most people don't see a person or an organization that embodies an alternative to the Bush plan. And if one starts to emerge, I think people will start to galvanize behind it.
Let me ask you, I mean, as I was thinking about this last night, I think a move toward the end, and as I say, I think that end should be the only thing we're pursuing, that end being the ending of an occupation. There may still be some sort of presence, and there's got to, but to end that it would start by redefining our role in light of Iraq's realities of today, rather than just accepting the role that we bumbled into in the invasion and the missteps since, and that if we redefine that role, I think that role would then also be turned over to a multinational force of which we might or might not even be a member, of which we might or might not take a combat role. What do you think of that?
I think the reality or the likelihood of a multinational force taking over this mess in Iraq is pretty low, unfortunately. And I think what we have to start to do is dramatically downgrade our expectations. Stop talking about victory, and let's start talking about managing our expectations and coming up with the best possible outcome of a number of bad decisions. At this point, Iraq is never going to look like New Jersey. So we've got to accept that. We've got to think about how to kind of do geopolitical triage. We've got to stop the bleeding here and figure out how we can protect our interests in the region, get our people out of the middle of a civil war, and at the same time deal with the likelihood of, for example, a Sunni genocide. If the Shias do take power, how do we prevent the majority from annihilating the minority? We've got to be mindful of that. And I think at the end of the day, what we've got to do is think long and hard and with great detail about how we get out of Iraq, because we didn't do it on the way in, and we don't want to make that mistake again on the way out.
Mm-hmm. What do vets think about, this will be kind of the final question, what do vets think about what's coming out of this administration towards Iran?
I think they're concerned. I think what it reveals for us is the fact that our military is dramatically overextended. Everybody's concerned about repeated deployments. Our equipment's in shambles. You've moved units away from areas like Korea and Afghanistan into Iraq, and in many ways, we're strategically fixed. We've got all our eggs in one basket. So when you bang on the drum and threaten Iran, I think people in the military are concerned because they know how overextended we are right now. And President Bush has always said we've got to fight them over there so we don't have to fight them over here. Well, what all of us in the military say is, what if you've got to do both? Mm-hmm. And what if you've got to do it tomorrow?
Mm-hmm.
That's the type of pragmatic approach I think people in the military are concerned about.
Let me ask you one final personal question. You say in your book, Chasing Ghosts, that you wanted more than anything to be a warrior. And in your work with IAVA and Chasing Ghosts, do you still consider yourself a warrior?
Oh, absolutely. I just think it's a different kind of battle now. When we come home, we face a multitude of issues ranging from the political debate to post-traumatic stress disorder and divorce rates. And I've fallen into this job, and I wish I didn't have to do it, but it does give me purpose. And the thousands of veterans that we have that are part of our organization want to continue to serve their country in another way. And there's a great quote by George Washington that says, when we assume the soldier, we do not lay aside the citizen. And I think we're all looking for ways to take our skills and take our patriotism and our love for country and turn it into something else now that we're home. And I think a lot of veterans are doing that through the veterans movement, some through the anti-war movement, and a lot of them through politics or writing books or plays. And I think you'll see if there is a silver lining, there will be an amazing, inspired group of leaders that will come from this war.
Okay, so again, the book is Chasing Ghosts. The organization is Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. That's IAVA. The sites are paulreichoff.com, chasingghost.com, and IAVA.org. Thank you, Paul Reichoff. Keep up the good work.